Hello, and welcome to another edition of Brussels Sprouts. I'm Andrea Kendall-Taylor.
And I'm Jim Townsend.
And we're so glad you can join us. Today on Brussels Sprouts, we're continuing a series of podcasts that are focusing on the political drama and political theater in Europe. We previously recorded an episode on Brexit, and today we are turning our focus to Italy and the political theater that has been Italian politics over the last month of August. And to help us make sense of what's happening and where it's headed, we have with us Eric Jones. And Eric is the Director of European and Eurasian Studies and Professor of European Studies at SAIS at Johns Hopkins University. He's an expert in European politics and especially in Italy. So thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
And I should warn you, I went to SAIS and got out in 1982, so I know where all the bodies are buried.
Excellent.
So I just returned from a trip to Italy, although it was all vacation and a lot of gelato and cheese. And unfortunately, or fortunately for me, I was not paying as much attention to what has been happening in Italy. So I wonder if you, Eric, can give us just a little background of some of what has happened over the last couple of weeks, and then we can dive into how we got here.
Sure. The background is on about the 8th of August, the vice prime minister, a right-wing politician named Matteo Salvini, decided he could no longer support the coalition government that his party, the Lega, had with a more left-leaning party called the Five Star Movement. And when he made that decision, he asked the prime minister to resign, and the prime minister refused, saying that the government would last so long as parliament hadn't voted a lack of confidence in the government. And that started a whole long process as Salvini tried to bring down his own government, and the government tried to prevent that from happening, a process that's ended with his former coalition partners, the Five Star Movement, getting into bed with the Democratic Party, which is the fierce opposition. So somehow this guy Salvini has given birth to or created his own worst nightmare, taking his allies and his opponents and putting them in the same bed.
And how did we get here? I mean, what kind of led to this political mess? I mean, one, you know, factor that's contributed to this is obviously Salvini and the League has done quite well with voters in Italy. They did extremely well in European parliamentary elections. So he obviously had some incentive to take the government to elections and to try to kind of get a majority for himself. But what are the other factors? I mean, before we started recording, you talked about that this is really is a kind of an unprecedented time in Italian politics. How do we get here?
So Italy, like many countries in Europe, is facing a crisis with its traditional political class. The people are fed up with the way politics is done, and they're fed up with politicians, the same old faces that they see every day. And in March of 2018, they voted for the none of the above candidates. The Five Star Movement emerged as the largest political party. And on the center right, the Lega, this right-wing party that I've been talking about, emerged as the largest political group there as well. And these were never meant to be natural allies, but they did have this thing in common that they rejected the traditional elite. So for a whole year, these guys governed together. Their effectiveness as a coalition was not outstanding, but they did manage to achieve some legislative accomplishments. They also managed to antagonize the supporters on both sides. So Matteo Salvini looked at this and said, you know, I've gained enough popularity after a year in government. He started with 17% of the electorate, and by July, he was up at about 38% of the electorate. So he said, I've gained enough popularity in government that now I can pull the plug on this government and try to run by myself. And that's felt more natural to him. What wasn't natural was how badly he miscalculated the dynamics he would set in motion.
Definitely. You know, there's also been some strange twists and turns in terms of the Italian relationship, at least over the past year or so, the government's relationship with the Trump administration on the one hand, and also with Putin on the other hand. And so there's been watching not just this domestic drama play out, but also over a longer period of time, this kind of foreign policy that's a bit different than we're used to seeing. Would you have any comment on that, and will that change now? Will there be a different kind of approach or viewpoint or feeling about Moscow, or is that going to stay the same, and the same with the Trump administration?
So let's talk about foreign policy, and then we'll talk about Moscow. Now, on the foreign policy, the big resonance between the Italian government that we had up until the beginning of August and the Trump administration lies in the notion of national sovereignty.
Right.
They believe that national sovereignty should be more important than any other relationship that they have with anyone else. And in that sense, they were able to find common bond. The Lega, and to a certain extent also the Five Star Movement, look at Russia as an expression of national sovereignty. So there's a lot of admiration for what Russia has done as an independent force in European politics. Mm-hmm. Doesn't mean that they have the same relationship with Russia that the United States has or even want to aspire to that level, but it does mean that they look at it as a kind of a symbol. There's a third dimension that we should probably bring out. There are personal relationships between the Lega and people in Russia that have been uncovered increasingly by BuzzFeed, and
right.
that is creating a level of complication that we hadn't really anticipated up to this point.
More broadly speaking, when we think about what the implications of this new government will be, so obviously, again, you talked about, you know, kind of unusual bedfellows with the Democrats and the Five Star Movement now coming together. What will be the basis of their agenda? What commonalities do they have? How are they going to move forward? There's certainly a lot of issues that need to be addressed in the coming months, particularly the economic situation. So what do you think will be the future, or where is this new government headed?
And how long will it last?
They've managed to hammer out a 26-point plan. And you can look at the plan and divine which party proposed which elements. But there are certain things that emerge as common themes. They believe in the better provision of social services, for example. They believe in integrating the protection of the environment into the development model. So these are themes that I think would resonate also in American politics with particular constituencies. The points that make them harder to understand are when they begin to talk about how they're going to balance the budget and yet spend a lot of money on all these different things at the same time, because then you start to wonder how they're going to square that circle. They also talk about the need for engaging with Europe, but transforming Europe, because they want Europe to be expressing more solidarity in the area of migration, where Italy is a frontier state that absorbs lots of migrants and needs help dealing with them. But they also want Europe to give them more flexibility in terms of fiscal policy and to stop interfering with how their market and economy are organized. I mean, in terms of migration and fiscal policy, these are themes where we expect to see more tension, particularly as we go into the budget season, which culminates in October and November.
One question, so we at CNAS are doing some work on populism in Europe, and one of the questions, the perennial questions, is, you know, when the cordon sanitaire, like, when do you bring populists in, when do you exclude them from politics? And clearly the Democrats have been willing to form a coalition with the Five Star Movement. My understanding is that they set out a list of conditions that Five Star had to be willing to agree to in order to form the coalition. Can you talk a little bit about those and how you see that working?
Yeah, what you should know about the Democratic Party and the Five Star Movement, the Democratic Party is not naturally averse to the Five Star Movement. This is a learned behavior. In 2013, when the Five Star Movement first emerged on the scene at the national level with 25% of the vote, the Democratic Party thought initially to negotiate with them in order to form a government. And the Five Star Movement, which hates the traditional elite, used the negotiations as an opportunity relentlessly to humiliate the leadership of the Democratic Party. And the leadership of the Democratic Party after that said, "We're never going to work with these guys. They're totally untrustworthy."
Not a good way to put together a coalition.
Well, I mean, it's not that they were populist in the sort of conventional speech sense of the term. It's that they were populist in the very narrow academic meaning of the term, which is that they hated the corrupt elite and they used anything they could to overturn it. Fast forward to the present, and what is so surprising about this arrangement is that the marriage broker between the Democratic Party and the Five Star Movement is Matteo Renzi, the former prime minister, who now, for whatever reasons, personifies the elite, and he withdrew his objection to negotiations taking place. And that's what made this possible. Having said that, there's still no love lost between these two parties. They're doing this more than anything to keep the Salvini-Lega group out of power. And in doing so, what they're hoping is that Salvini will take a hit politically and they won't have to fear him as much in the future.
While we're on the topic of populism and Salvini, what's next for Salvini? I mean, he's obviously, you know, demonstrated his ability to, we were talking about, use social media, Facebook and other things to really raise his own personal profile. The League really is kind of a party that is all about supporting his charismatic leadership. He obviously miscalculated, and so what's next for him?
So Salvini is interesting because Salvini represents populism not in the academic speak, but in the conventional speak, right? Let's not forget, the Lega is Italy's oldest political party, and it has participated in governments in the 1990s, in the 2000s, and all the way into the most recent decade. And what Salvini has been trying to do is to craft this into a majority party that controls the country. He's failed at that. But that doesn't stop him from doing what he does best, which is, as opposition, poking holes in the government and criticizing it any way he can. And we're going to see that happen because the sailing season from North Africa to Italy has not closed yet. As boats begin to arrive with ever-increasing numbers of migrants on them, and the new government welcomes these migrants rather than pushing them back out into the sea, which is what Salvini has been doing, Salvini is going to get on social media, he's going to hammer them for their lack of respect for law and order, and for their unwillingness to stand up for the principles of the Italian people. And that's going to play very well with an electorate that he has trained to be fearful of immigration over the past 18 months.
But could he fizzle out as did Renzi before him? So these kind of charismatic leaders who go from rags or riches to rags.
He certainly could. If he, you know, overreaching is not something that's admired in Italy. And you'll see in his public approval ratings, he lost about 15 percentage points going from the high 40s down to the low 30s just as a result of this overreach in the 8th of August. If he does a series of these kinds of gaffes, then his support could fall back down again. How far it could fall is hard to say. It looks as though he's got about 17 to 20% of the electorate locked up in a solid way, and what he's playing for is everything above that. And right now, he's still in the low 30s, so he's doing okay.
You know, one of the characteristics that marked the last number of months is a tendency in Rome of the coalition to throw rocks at the EU. And they take a great pride in thumbing their nose at Brussels and warning that a Brexit Italian style is going to happen, and you know this type of thing. That's now that government is gone. There's a new coalition. Do you think Brussels can breathe a sigh of relief that the rocks from Rome are going to stop, or is this really something that's kind of in the political DNA in Rome, and there's never going to be a chance for Brussels to breathe easy that the Italians are going to come alongside?
First, I think Brussels is breathing easy right now. They look at this as just, oh, thank goodness, Italy is returning to normal. And second, much more problematically, if you look at the public opinion polling numbers, what you see is that Italian admiration for Europe, their belief in the benefits of European integration, their feeling of attachment for Europe have all been on the decline for the last two and a half decades. So there's a long-standing problem that was expressed also under the Renzi government. The Renzi government very famously pushed back against Europe on a number of different issues. That was a traditional elite democratic party that was doing that. Now in the pockets with the five-star movement, we should expect even more tensions because no one can surrender national sovereignty to European institutions without being taken to task by Matteo Salvini or even by Beppe Grillo and the five-star movement.
Yeah.
On the economic front, you mentioned before kind of the difficulty they may have in balancing kind of some kind of fiscal conservatism with promises from the five-star movement to kind of provide more social welfare and benefits, that there's going to be a tension there. And I know that Italy is kind of in a tough economic spot, right? There's a lot of decisions that need to be made prior to December. What is the economic outlook? Because clearly a default would be disastrous for the EU. What are the odds of that happening? Or do you think this new government is going to be able to do what it needs to do in order to avoid that kind of situation?
So first, a default on Italian sovereign debt is very, very unlikely. A lot of the uncertainty that was associated with the Lega and with the previous coalition was uncertainty not about their ability to pay the debt, but about their willingness to challenge the norms, conventions, and rules that govern macroeconomic policy coordination in Europe. And that uncertainty created a huge increase in the cost of borrowing that was slowing down the economy. Now there's a greater belief in financial markets that this new government is going to play by the rules, and playing by the rules makes it easier to invest in their debt. And let's face it, their debt is about the only debt that's out there that's very liquid and that pays a positive yield at anything like a reasonable maturity structure. So you buy this Italian debt because you're paying money to buy debt from other countries. And so this is a good thing. So I think in that sense, we're going to see a benefit to the Italian economy. But as you pointed out, the Italian economy faces a number of challenges, and some of those challenges are deeply structural in origin. And the question is whether this coalition could tackle those things. I think that's just an unrealistic expectation to put on this coalition. It doesn't have the kind of cohesiveness that the Renzi government had, for example.
And do you think the Italian-U.S. Bilateral relationship is going to not change over time, or with the new government? Steve Bannon had gone to Italy, was setting up a little academy for populism or whatever it was that he was doing there, and it seemed back a year or so ago that there was going to be this kind of tight ideological relationship between some in Rome and some in the administration. It's different now, how will U.S.-Italian foreign policy relations, how will that change?
And maybe the one other thing I might throw in there, too, is China. So with Italy kind of just signing on to the Belt and Road Initiative, how is Rome going to balance the EU, the U.S., and China? Big questions.
So let's do the closeness of the previous coalition and the Trump administration. Now, one could argue that closeness was based on ideological affinity that runs through Steve Bannon. But then you have to ask yourself, well, how much has Steve Bannon maintained his influence in the White House?
Right.
And I don't think that's really such a big deal. I think we've created in Steve Bannon this kind of bugbear that we think has all these magical powers that he just doesn't really have. And by the way, he didn't put that government together either.
Yeah.
Anyway. But there is another side to it, which is Giuseppe Conte, which is this guy who was plucked out of nowhere to become the Italian prime minister. And he befriended Donald Trump at the first G20 summit in Canada when nobody else was being nice to Donald Trump. And Conte has continuously come back and been not, I wouldn't say he's not flattering. He just treats Donald Trump like a normal guy. And they seem to have developed a relationship strong enough that when Conte was looking to stabilize his role, Donald Trump gave him an endorsement, which is kind of unique in many respects. And I think that personal relationship between Conte, who will remain as prime minister, and Donald Trump is probably going to remain. Now, will it be beset by policy differences? Absolutely. Policy differences over China, first and foremost. But how much does the Trump administration really focus on Italy and its attitude toward China in the context of Belt and Road, and how much does the Trump administration focus on trade and look at Europe and China as two different forms of competition?
Right, right.
And I think that the Italy special relationship with China gets washed out completely in this focus on Germany and cars and China and everything else.
Yeah.
So I want to talk just a little bit more on the Italy China relationship, and what we've seen so far is Europe really has struggled to come up with a unified position on how it's going to manage its relations with China. So can you tell us a little bit about the factors that are driving Italy's approach to China and kind of what that relationship looks like? Clearly, China has invested in ports in Piraeus and other places. So can you just give us a quick overview of what's driving Italy's approach to China and where you think that's going?
So Italy's approach to China is really interesting because it's being driven by one figure who was a state secretary, so a junior minister from the Five Star Movement, who happened to have a past business dealings in China and happened to know China. And he persuaded Conte, who played this prime minister I've been talking about, who played a personal role in reactivating the Italy-China relationship, and then bringing in the promise of lots of investment that would develop infrastructure, but also industry in key areas in the Italian economy. And one of those would be, for example, the port city of Trieste, which is all the way at the north of the Adriatic. It's a port city that hasn't been well connected to the rest of Europe in a long time. And the Chinese have come and offered to buy this and to connect it to the rest of Europe, creating a transshipment point that would dominate in many respects over even Piraeus, because it'll be so much more and better connected than other investments that China's made.
You know, it's so interesting, the relationship that Italy must have, not just with China, but as the other European nations look at Italy and watch what Italy is doing with China, and watch this investment go in, and maybe as other European countries look at Italy, they might be thinking that Italy's being able to take advantage of things that they're not going to be able to take advantage of because they're not playing the game the way Italy does. And I'm wondering how, when the Italians walk into Strasbourg or into Brussels and they sit with the other European nations, I wonder if they look at Italy and go, so how are the Chinese today?
Well, I think that would be an overestimation in terms of Italy's role in this relationship with China. Because let's not forget, China has also cultivated a relationship that's called the 16 plus 1.
Now 17 plus 1, right?
Now 17 plus 1. With many of the countries of Central and Eastern Europe, and has tried to create many different and competing points of entry for Chinese goods into the European marketplace. So everybody knows that this is happening. They also know that they've become increasingly and incredibly reliant on Chinese technology for example, 5G. So Huawei plays an important part in the development of the 5G standard in the European context that they can't really escape from. So in that sense, I think everybody is looking at everybody else and trying to figure out how they can outdo one another. And this is why you see European policy toward China look so fragmented, because they really haven't figured it out, and they've become divided and disunited as a consequence.
Do you think the Italians do more with the Chinese than some of the other countries, or is it there's not really a front runner in terms of embed with Beijing?
No, I don't think it's really a front runner. And you know what is interesting in the Italian context is the extent to which Made in Italy has become a feature of immigrant Chinese labor in the Italian economy working at Chinese wages. So. when you look at Made in Italy textiles, for example, many of them are produced in Italy by the Chinese.
Which is that's interesting.
Really fascinating. And there are whole communities of Chinese immigrants that you wouldn't see if you went on holiday because they're self-segregated. But they're working in the Italian fashion industry and producing things that it would be politically difficult to outsource to China, for example.
One last question, going back to the issue of populism. So one thing we're thinking about, too, is kind of the future of populism and where these trends are headed. In neighboring Greece, we just saw Syriza lost power and you had a return to a more centrist party. Now in Italy, at least this far right league party has had some of the wind out of its sails. Where do you think these populist parties in Italy are headed? Has it crested, and now we're going to see kind of their support decline and put them back as more kind of marginal actors in the political system? Or do you still think this trend has some legs?
So this is why I keep making that distinction between conventional use of the term populism and academic use of the term populism. There are some populist movements that are really new political forces that have emerged where traditional political parties have failed to represent the electorate. Five Star Movement would fall in that category. And those populist groups tend to be much more fragile because they're not well institutionalized, because they don't have a deep bench of political talent, and because they don't have a long list of issues where they've actually thought things through. By contrast, something like the Lega, it's not really a populist party in that academic sense. It's a populist party only in conventional speech. We call it populist because we don't like them. And yet they're an old party, they're well institutionalized, they've got a deep bench of talent, they've got long experience in government, and they've got a well-articulated program. So they're much harder to break open than the Five Star Movement is. So the Lega went down to 3-4% of the vote in 2013, and now it's up at over 30. That shows you what really strong institutions can accomplish.
Thank you so much for joining us. This has been such a fantastic conversation and helped get me up to speed on all things Italy. There's just such a breadth of interesting topics from China and populism and kind of the economic situation. So thanks for helping us make sense of all of it.
Yeah, thank you very much and look forward to seeing you again.
Absolutely. Thank you very much for having me here.